Hello, this is a show from Radio. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners.
Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond.
Delta 2 Yankee, Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Are you up for it?
Listen to the radio station where the mighty hosts of heaven sing. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. If you want to hear the songs of Zion come from the land of endless spring, get in touch with God. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. And listen to the music in the air. Turn your radio on. Glory share, turn the lights down low, and listen to the Master's radio. Get in touch with God, turn your radio on. Brother, listen to the Glory Land chorus, listen to the glad Hosanna's roar. Turn your radio on, turn your radio on. Get a little taste of joy's waiting. Get a little heaven in your soul. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. And listen to the music in the air. Turn your radio on. And glory share. Turn the lights down low. And listen to the Master's radio. Get in touch with God. Listen to the songs of the fathers and the mothers and the many friends gone on before. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. Some eternal morning we shall meet them over on the Hallelujah shore. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. And listen to the music in the air. Turn your radio on. Glory share, turn the lights down low, and listen to the Master's radio. Get in touch with God, turn your radio on.
That was Saul Brody with Turn Your Radio On, performed earlier this month at the Shortwave Shindig, the SWL Fest in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in the United States. I'm Tom Rowe with Wavefarm and WGXC, in the Hudson Valley in New York, in the United States, and this week we're listening in to Shortwave on the radio show around the world. Earlier this year, Australian Broadcasting ended its shortwave transmissions, just the latest in a long line of cutbacks, but especially noticeable as shortwave is such an invaluable service in remote areas of Australia and the Pacific. This week on the radio show, we'll tune in two different stories about shortwave broadcasting, one mourning the end and one celebrating the continuation. First, we'll hear from Canadian artist Amanda Dawn Christie about her Spectres of Shortwave film just released. And then we'll tune in bits of the Shortwave Shindig, just happened at the SWL Fest in March of 2017 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, broadcast on Wavefarm Radio. Right now we're hearing Particle Showers from William Baczynski from his 2007 release Shortwave Music. Next, we recently spoke with Amanda Dawn Christie about her film Spectres of Shortwave. It's almost finished, about an array of antennas from Radio Canada International that caused parts of a local community to hear radio waves in their kitchen appliances. Let's listen to Amanda Dawn Christie and her story of Spectres of Shortwave. And I'm Tom Rowe, and Amanda Dawn Christie is here. You're screening...
Spectres of Shortwave is the English title, and the French title is Ombre des Ondes Courtes. And it's about a shortwave radio site that was recently dismantled in Canada. And the film, it's a feature-length experimental documentary, and it's about the Radio Canada International site. And that site was, it was near where I grew up, so a lot of locals, and myself included, just saw it as this amazing, interesting part of the landscape. It was 13 radio towers, 400 feet tall, all connected with antennas, and it's in this, situated in this marsh that's below sea level, so anytime you're driving home at night, what you see is all those red lights. And a lot of locals don't necessarily know what this, or didn't know what the site was for, and I started the project mostly documenting the images and the fact that people would hear the radio in their household appliances sometimes, sinks, fridges, toasters, and that fascinated me. And the more research I did, then I found out that was when I got interested in radio and shortwave radio. And as I started the film, our government made some pretty major budget cuts and they decided to tear it down. So my project drew out for an extra few years to include the demolition of the site, which I think it was quite tragic.
Did they sell it for scrap metal or?
Yeah. And I was told unofficially that, I mean, there was a station in Singapore that actually offered to buy it, and they basically said no. It was worth more to them as scrap metal. And when I was documenting the demolition, I wasn't allowed to post any photos on Facebook or Twitter because they were afraid people would come and steal metal. There was, I think they said, 60,000 pounds of copper from just the wires, let alone all the steel. So it wasn't.
And copper was going through a big price hike internationally at the time, I believe.
Yeah, that was 2014. They got quite a lot of money for that. And and officially, like even CBC and the Radio Canada, there wasn't a lot of documentation. I think one night they did a little thing on the evening news in English, and over the course of 4 months, twice on the French CBC, and no one else was documenting it. So I think it's still a work in progress phase, because editing the film right after it came down was a bit emotional for me. There was a lot of weight feeling like the only person who was there on site documenting as a kind of a witness to the loss of this very important piece of communication technology. It was the largest site of its kind in Canada, and it was built during World War II, and it was the first Allied site to break through the jamming signals of the Iron Curtain, and contracted by Radio China, Korea, Vietnam, quite a few other countries used this relay transmission site. And it was transmitting to the Arctic in the north of Canada, so as a source of news for people in very remote communities up north, it was very important. And then there was this idea that, well, everyone's got the internet, so who needs shortwave, which I think is very short-sighted.
You said there's not much, you were the only documenter of the destruction. Is there a lot of documentation of the toasters receiving radio signals?
As far as I've come across, no one has done audio recordings of them, and I don't have audio recordings of them, because that phenomenon apparently became less and less frequent after the 1970s. They put a lot of filters, they found
ways. And
that's,
of course, when the small cassette recorders became available in the 1970s.
Yeah. And so they did stuff with filters and helped people to prevent that from happening. There was an older woman in the community who apparently heard radio in her sink for 2 hours every Sunday evening, but she didn't want me coming into her house. She was like the mother-in-law of a friend of a friend. And so I built my own radio sync. I took the schematic of a foxhole radio, or crystal radio, rather, and built it using copper plumbing. So I'd go to the plumbing store after every paycheck and buy another 12 feet of copper, and I would take it out on the marsh to try and hear the radio, trying to build a functioning radio without any electronics. in the end, it didn't work because I didn't have enough pipe. Like, I would have needed, I think, to catch the shortwave, I would have needed about 40 meters of pipe, and I had, you know, 24 feet, because copper was expensive. So I'm still working on that project as well. So mostly what I've recorded is interviews with people who experienced hearing the radio from their fridge and their toaster and their sink, and most of it was in their childhood or teenage years. I didn't meet many people who still experienced that in 2010 to 2012.
And kind of your, it seems like what I'm hearing is your kind of theory of why that would happen is the same as why you would twist metal wires into to be able to receive signals in a foxhole radio is basically a term for during the war people made radios with whatever materials they had to receive signals, and so and this seems to go with along with the theremin too is the twisting metal in certain ways, which is what the towers were doing on a large scale, a large more organized scale, I guess. Or maybe not, if it was causing sinks to become radius. But so is that what it's sort of a metaphor for the towers themselves? What you're doing
with the theremin or the
with the theremin? Yeah.
Well, the theremin is kind of more of because I'd been working on the project for about 5 years or more, and I became very emotionally attached to the towers. So the theremin became that project's. It's a metaphor, but the project's called Requiem for Radio. And it's the idea is to play the ghosts of the radio towers with radio waves. So what I'll be doing with the theremins is there were 13 radio towers, and I want to build 13 theremins, one for each tower, to set up a scale model of the site. And the height of the theremin antennas will be relative to the height of the radio towers. And instead of hearing theremin sounds, it was interesting that you mentioned the contact mic recordings, because I had, when the towers were still standing, I put contact microphones on each of the radio towers to record their vibrations in the wind. At that point, they weren't transmitting anymore, but the marsh had very high winds. And so I've got these beautiful droning sounds that are almost like a voice for each tower. And so when I set up the scale model with the theremins, I'm writing a Maximus P patch so that the theremin becomes more of a trigger. So when you approach, say, theremin number 3, it'll trigger the sound of tower number 3. So it's this idea of conjuring the ghosts of the radio towers, even though it's all scientific and electromagnetic. It's this play of kind of requiem and remembering the past of that site.
All right, we're speaking with Amanda Dawn Christie about Spectres of Shortwave. Do you want to tell people anything about the film?
Sure. It started off as a landscape film, so it's not your traditional documentary. There's no talking heads. You're not going to see any people, but you'll hear people, like listening to the radio. And the imagery is, I filmed the site over 4 seasons, so spring, summer, fall, winter. And so it's various shots of the site, long, slow, meditative, a lot of driving shots. I filmed on 35mm film and scanned to digital. And then in the winter is the demolition, so the last 20 or 30 minutes of the film is just watching the site being dismantled. And the soundtrack, you'll hear stories from local residents in English and French, and because there's 2 languages in the region. And the film is, I chose not to subtitle it because radio is not subtitled. And one of the things I found interesting about international radio is that there are so many languages and you don't always understand them. So to me, if you don't understand one of the languages, I'm treating it like it's music. And it's just imagine you're tuning into international radio. And the background sounds, there's these drones. And those drones in the background were all recorded when I placed contact microphones on the radio towers. And then the very final 20, 30 minutes. So you'll hear people talking in the first two-thirds of the film. Locals talking about the significance in the landscape. There's a section with people talking about hearing the radio in their household appliances. And there's sections of the technicians explaining how the site worked and what it did. And then as we watch the demolition, there's no voices. At that point, we're just watching. And my approach to making a documentary is I want the viewer to be more in the seat of a witness than a student. I didn't want to be an authority telling you how it is and what it is. I wanted it to be as if you stumbled across it the way I did. And that's why I've intercut stories by locals. So you're going to overhear the same stories that I heard when I was living there. And when the camera is going through the facility, because I also went inside the facility, going through the hallways and the transmitters and everything, I'm not necessarily going to explain what they are. It's going to be as if you've arrived there and you're exploring it on your own and overhearing local stories. And when the demolition happens, I want you to feel like you're there too, watching it like I did. The Radio Canada International Shortwave Transmission Site, located in Sackville, New Brunswick, transmitted from 1944 to 2012. Le site de transmission d'ondes courtes de Radio-Canada International, situé à Sackville, au Nouveau-Brunswick, a transmis de 1944 à 2012.
Il y a de magnifiques tours. They broadcast in shortwave
radio. When they turned their hot water tap on, they
Europe,
would get the sound of the radio
Africa,
coming out of their
South
faucet.
America,
which I think is amazing.
The sounds were not necessarily clear, they were clearly voices.
Les canaux d'irrigation que les Acadiens construisent.
I can tell you that some of the supply voltages are on the order of 14,000 volts.
When I told him that I was dreaming in other measurements that I didn't know.
Les ondes courtes de Radio-Canada couvrent la moitié du globe.
And here I am on the other side of the world, connected.
Well, it was quite exciting. This was the first tower that went up was for CBA, and it was I think 480 feet. They broadcast almost all over the world.
The site at Sackville was chosen because of the ground characteristics for shortwave broadcast. The salt marsh created an excellent place to broadcast from, and we broadcast to a number of locations around the world. The primary locations were in Africa. When it was first set up, the site, we broadcast to Germany, to Asia, and after a period of time, we started broadcasting to the U.S., to Central America, to South America. And I think for a period of time in the past, we broadcast to Australia. Basically, we could broadcast anywhere we wanted to the world just by selecting the antenna and the amount of power and the frequency that we used.
Je vois l'évolution de l'humain. Je vois au-devant donc les marais que les Acadiens ont endigués pour leur subsistance, qui était à l'époque, l'agriculture était leur subsistance, et on en voit les tracés dans les marais qui restent. Et ces antennes qui sont peut-être pas la subsistance, mais qui sont la réalité d'après-guerre, donc la réalité qu'on a voulu développer de la communication pour assurer que le Canada et les intérêts du Canada et la culture du Canada soient reconnus mondialement.
Amanda Dawn Christie talking about her new film, Spectres of Shortwave. Next, we'll travel to Pennsylvania, the United States, and hear bits of the Shortwave Shindig, celebrating shortwave broadcasting in the United States this past March 2017.
Thank you. revolutionary voice of the shortwave shindig, broadcasting live from the Quaker Socialist Republic of Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania, a free voice in the Americas. We're coming to you via the mighty blowtorch of the Everglades, WRMI, Okeechobee, Florida, on the assigned frequencies of 6855 and 9395 kilohertz. And now, here's the host of the shortwave shindig, David Gorin!
Hi, everybody!
Hello, world!
Donna, 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 Donna! Hey! Glad you're all tuning in. Welcome to the Shortwave Shindig, live from the 30th Annual Winter Shortwave Listeners Fest. We're excited to be back on the air celebrating the 30th Fest and the shortwave listening experience with our resident folk singer, Saul Brody, and special guests. And now, a word from a shortwave broadcaster you might be familiar with.
Hi, this is Brother Stair, with the Ulmer Company to be the most prolific shortwave broadcaster on the air today, and we're congratulating you all as you join together here with the North American Shortwave Association on the occasion of the 30th Annual Winter SWL Day. God bless you. Tune in shortwave and hear Brother Stair on the Ulmer Company. Maranatha.
Maranatha to you too, Brother Stair. Anyway, it was nice of him to do that. So, and he was right. He's the most prolific, right?
Yeah.
Hey, who do we have here? Why, it's Richard Cuff and John Fliegliozzi, who are our Festmeisters, and they want to welcome you to the 30th Annual Fest and the Shortwave Shindig. So, how's it going, guys?
I think it's going pretty good.
Yeah, so far it's we had a bonus day since it was number 30, so we've been festing for more than 24 hours already. Have already had a series of great forums and a great time of talking about radio and remembering fests of the past and celebrating the future of radio in all its forms. So it's been great so far.
So, how's the fest changed over the years, and what are some signature moments?
Well, I mean, you can see how its origins in the name of it, the Winter SWL Shortwave Listeners Festival. It was almost completely devoted to shortwave listening at the beginning, but over time, radio has changed, and with it, the fest has changed to expand its remit to what we call now radio in all its forms, all the platforms that radio uses, to try to make it more enjoyable, or as enjoyable as it can be, for not only those listening, but for those who see it as a hobby as well.
And we've also, for decades actually, featured elements of the radio hobby beyond just shortwave. There have been the Scanner Scum have been part of the fest for many years. And, of course, that isn't exactly a short way, but nonetheless, it's radio and radio hobby-related activities. So we've had the Scanner Scum for years. And, of course, as John has mentioned, we've gone beyond the world of short way to focus on the kinds of content that were historically delivered by shortwave and ways to experience that content nowadays as well, and ways to experiment with new technologies to hear radio as an experimenter and hobbyist might be interested.
So what do you see in the future for the fest? Surely it was changing, but people, interest is remaining in the things that you just talked about.
Well, I mean, I think the future of the fest will be guided by the people that you see in this audience here. It's going to be, as long as people continue to come, as long as people continue to show interest, as long as their interests expand, the fest will expand along with it. And I think we're tickled pink it's gone 30 years. I mean, it's hard to believe that some of us were just mere youths when we started this. But, and you know, while we're still young in spirit, I think when we walk past the mirror, we learn something a little bit different. But we hope to go as long as the fest is, as long as everyone here will carry us.
And I would add that John puts out a casting call for folks to prepare forums and to prepare subject matter. And we had to turn folks away this year. We just did not have the time available for all of the great ideas that folks had for the fest and for forums. So that gives us encouragement as well, knowing that there is interest in presenting, because not only is it just interest in participating and folks showing up to be here, but folks willing to put together the technical sessions. The fest has always been about the combination of fellowship and education. Now, back in some of the original notes that the founders had assembled along the way, and that was a critical goal that they had that we intend to keep going, is this combination of fellowship and fun, a family unit environment, as well as education, the capability to learn.
Great. Well, thanks, guys, and thanks for the great work you do putting this together.
And thanks. Thank you for being here and putting on the shindig.
Thank you. Okay.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm. Over and out.